from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Worrying about the health effects of plastics in our consumer economy can drive you crazy. Maybe it should. Many studies have raised big questions over the chemical bisphenol A, BPA, in plastics. Now there's a big fight over whether substitutes for BPA in plastic could themselves be dangerous. It's a battlefield. The stakes are life and death. It's hard to know what to trust. This hour on Point, plastics and safety beyond BPA. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you gone back to mason jars? What needs to happen here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Mariah Blake, reporter for Mother Jones. Her big investigative story is headlined, "The Scary New Evidence on BPA-Free Plastics and the Big Tobacco-Style Campaign to Bury It." You can link to her piece from our website, onpointradio.org. Mariah Blake, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much for having me.
What have you found?
Well, where do I begin? Essentially, I have found that, according to the research that's been done, the majority of commercially available plastics may have properties that are similar to BPA. And by that, I mean they leach chemicals that mimic the hormone estrogen. And this is known to cause a variety of serious health problems. The chemical BPA is the most studied, but there is a growing body of evidence that suggests these kinds of chemicals generally can cause just a wide range of negative health effects.
Remind us of that range, Mariah.
Well, in the case of BPA, it ranges from breast and prostate cancer to diabetes to increased aggression, reproductive problems, so infertility. The list is very, very long.
Let's start with BPA. Everybody now, or lots of people, are shopping for BPA-free plastics, that water bottle, that stuff for the baby. Nobody wants BPA in it. But just to stick with BPA, because there's a lot of it still in our economy, and in particular, in things in containers associated with eating, like the insides of cans and bottles still, the FDA says it's safe at the very low levels that occur in some foods. I'm reading here from their own, description. FDA says it's safe. So what's the problem, Mariah?
Well, the FDA historically has a very cozy relationship with the industry. And in fact, in 2008, it came to light that the FDA was relying on industry lobbyists to write its evaluations of BPA. It also came to light that its finding that BPA was not harmful was based almost entirely on two industry-funded studies, one of which was fatally flawed.
So here we've still got BPA in the economy, in the environment, in the things that are around what we eat. There's no law against it, right? I mean, the FDA has said, no, don't put it in baby bottles, in sippy cups, in packaging for formula. But beyond that, there's no restriction on the use of BPA. Where does it still show up, Mariah?
Well, it's ubiquitous, really. It's still in many plastic containers. It is in cash register receipts. So if you get a cash register receipt that has that sort of slippery quality,
yeah,
that's
sure.
Because it has a BPA coating on it. It's in the lining of tin cans, so there's this epoxy resin lining in tin cans that they use to keep foods fresh. That often contains BPA.
So it's still very much out there in our food environment. You're looking beyond that now. People are saying, okay, there's enough question around BPA. Many consumers are saying that I don't want to go there. The FDA has said don't put it in stuff for babies here. And what chemical companies have been eager to come out with alternatives that they are putting forward as BPA-free. What's the controversy over those?
Well, the emerging research on those shows that many of those also have what are known as estrogenic chemicals, so chemicals that mimic the natural hormone estrogen. That's what BPA does, and that is part of what makes it so harmful to animal and human health, potentially.
And who's claiming exactly what when it comes to these BPA alternatives?
Well, so the most comprehensive study was done by a lab in Texas called Certichem and a professor at Georgetown. and they tested 455 commercially available plastic products and found that the majority of them, the vast majority of them, were estrogenic. And they also found that every type of plastic that is commonly used in commercial packaging or in food containers. So, for example, there's peat, there's polycarbonate, there's various types of plastic, that every kind was estrogenic in some cases, which suggests there's no surefire way to avoid exposure.
So what's the conclusion that they draw from that, that we shouldn't use plastics at all, or that the what exactly?
Well, Certachem and Plastipure, their business is helping companies come up with, test their products for estrogenic activity and come up with products that are not estrogenic. So it is possible to make plastics that are not estrogenic. And there are certainly plastics on the market that are not estrogenic. It's just hard to figure out which ones they are based on the type of plastic, based on the number stamped on the bottom. You just can't tell.
This company in
Unless
Texas, Certachem, got in a big fight with a significant producer of an alternative to BPA. They went to court. Certachem lost. Give us the background on that. Eastman Chemical Co. of Tennessee. What's their stake in all this?
Eastman Chemical is a $7 billion a year company that was spun off from Eastman Kodak in the 1990s. Around the time that the dangers of BPA became widely known, so in 2007, 2008, they unveiled a new brand of plastic. It's called Triton. And it is the only plastic on the market that markets itself as free of all estrogenic activity. So it's not just BPA-free. It is supposedly free of all of these kinds of chemicals that can mess with your hormones.
So Eastman, big company, same company that you report produced the chemical that got into the drinking water of all those West Virginians in January. They went after Certachem pretty hard here. What was their argument?
Well, their chief argument was that the test that Bittner's company used, which has been around for for decades and is commonly used as a screening tool for estrogenic activity, was not sufficient to establish estrogenic activity.
So they went after his science and said he hadn't proven what he said he'd proven.
Yes. I should note that as a result of the trial, a lot of documents came to light. And they suggest that Eastman's own testing found that Triton was estrogenic.
The jury found the other way. That means at this point, right now, right, the law is on Eastman's side. What do you make of that?
Well, the jury was presented with the evidence, and they made the decision that they made. The Eastman relied largely on a former tobacco industry scientist who made the case that these kinds of tests were not sufficient to establish estrogenic activity. And that was ultimately the reason that the jury decided in Eastman's favor, according to follow-up interviews that were conducted by Certachem's attorneys.
There's a certain deja vu feeling around this that goes back, as you put right in your headline, to the battles over tobacco and its dangers. You've got it right there. You say it's a big tobacco-style campaign to bury evidence of the danger here. Describe that dynamic.
Well, so there's this famous tobacco industry document that came to light as part of the Master Settlement Agreement. And it quotes an executive as saying, "Doubt is their product." Or doubt is our product. So,
I mean, when there are claims of danger, respond with anything that will create doubt about those claims.
By sowing doubt, yes, because the way our regulatory system works. So chemicals are presumed safe until proven otherwise. So as long as you can sow doubt about the dangers, then you can shield your product from regulation. And so there's actually a former Clinton administration official named David Michaels who wrote a book about this called Doubt is Their Product. And I'd actually like to read just a couple of sentences from it, because I think it summarizes very effectively what the strategy is. So here goes. Industry has learned that debating the science is much easier and more effective than debating the policy. In field after field, year after year, conclusions that might support regulation are always disputed. Animal data are deemed not relevant, human data not representative, and exposure data not reliable. So essentially, they try to discredit safety testing in general.
You know, we'll have lots of people listening to this and thinking about what's on their shelves, what's in their backpack, what they've got their sandwich in for lunch today, what they heated in the microwave last night. What's your bottom line message here, Mariah?
Well, everybody has to make their own decisions, and plastic is ubiquitous. It's impossible to avoid it. I personally, I have a 3-year-old son. I have removed all plastic products from my home. However, we still buy groceries that are packaged in plastic. There is no way around it. I, based on what I've learned reporting this article, have chosen to use natural products whenever possible. But, you know, this is a very personal choice.
With all the sophisticated, detailed science here, isn't it kind of a strange state of affairs that everybody has to make their own decision? How on earth are people supposed to knowledgeably, confidently do that?
I wish I had a better answer to that question. You know, it's just, I think that this is part of the conundrum we find ourselves in. And it's part of a much broader issue. So getting back to the regulatory landscape, there are 80,000, roughly 80,000 chemicals that are used in commerce in the United States. Only a very small fraction of those have ever been tested for safety.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the safety of plastics beyond BPA. There's a big debate about risks to human health over a much wider range of plastics. Mariah Blake writes about it for Mother Jones in her big piece, the scary new evidence on BPA-free plastics and the big tobacco-style campaign to bury it. You can link to that piece at our website, onpointradio.org. Mariah joins us today from Washington. All kinds of BPA-free plastics being sold. It's a big tagline now in the marketing of products. Here's one ad for the original Baby Bullet food processor.
The Baby Bullet system teaches you what to feed your baby, when to feed, and how much to feed your baby at every stage of their development. With the Baby Bullet system, you can make and store a week's worth of baby food in under 5 minutes for less than $3. And the best part is the complete system is safe, non-toxic, and BPA-free.
Safe, non-toxic, BPA-free, that carries a certain meaning to most people. Eastman Chemical Company makes a lot of one of the substitutes for BPA. Here's an executive vice president there, Lucian Boldia, VP of the Specialty Plastics Division at Eastman, talking about their plastic, Triton.
We can see how available information about plastic materials can be confusing and how it can be difficult for consumers to tell what is really safe. We want you, the consumer, to know the facts behind our clear, tough material named Triton. Consumers can feel confident that the material used in their products is free of estrogenic activity.
Okay, there's the guarantee. The FDA says BPA, safe at very low levels. More to look at here on some of these alternatives. Here's the scientist who's done a lot of research on this, George Bittner, explaining to NPR back in 2012 what he found when he tested a wide range of plastic products made with BPA alternatives, including Triton.
We found that most other plastic products also released chemicals having estrogenic activity.
Bittner says even products that had no estrogenic activity when they came off the shelf changed under certain conditions.
Boiling, microwaving, dishwashing, or exposing to sunlight.
We'll hear a couple more perspectives on this and BPA in just a minute, BPA and beyond. Mariah Blake, standby in Washington. Lots of callers for you. Let me go to Aaron calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Aaron, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hello, Miss Blake. I am a regular reader of Mother Jones, and I've actually read Miss Blake's recent article. And I have to say, first of all, I just want to compliment her on this is real investigative journalism, and I appreciate that this is done, and this is why I read Mother Jones. But I'm really troubled by the whole BPA issue that's been going on for many years. I look around my home, my kitchen. I see plastic everywhere. Anything that my food touches has touched plastic at some point in time. The water, the clean water that comes out of my tap comes through some plastic at some point. My shower, the soap that I put on my body, everything has plastic. And so my children are affected and impacted by this plastic as well. And I'm very concerned. I did get rid of all my BPA products as best I could and tried to replace them. But then when I hear these researchers saying we're finding that all these other products have these same types of effects, just you know, slightly different, it makes me very frustrated that the United States government can't seem to do something about this, letting corporations fight good research and drive policy instead of science driving policy. The EU has done it. The Japanese got rid of BPA a long time ago, and strangely enough, their entire economy is still going strong, and they're all eating good food. Why can't we do the same? And I guess that's a question for Ms. Blake, is why is it that we can't seem to do what other advanced nations are doing?
Aaron, I appreciate your call from Omaha. Mariah, what do you say?
Well, Aaron, thank you. That's an excellent question. I wish I had a better answer. I think the main issue here is the way that chemicals are regulated. As I've mentioned before, in the United States, chemicals are presumed safe until proven otherwise. That is not the case in Europe. In Europe, they have what is called a precautionary approach. So they err on the side of regulating chemicals that may be hazardous rather than waiting until there is until it's proven 100% that something is hazardous.
But the suggestion here is we could take all these hazardous chemicals, potentially hazardous chemicals, out of our economy, that Japan's taken BPA out. I mean, could we really do that? I guess we could, Mariah, but
if it's
just so much wider than BPA. You take all that out, there would be a huge hiccup there. I don't know what form it would take, but it's so deeply entrenched in our packaging, in our construction.
I mean, that is absolutely true, but it is possible to make these products without estrogenic chemicals or what are known as endocrine disrupting chemicals, mm-hmm. generally chemicals that mimic hormones. That's the broader problem. So if regulation required it, or perhaps if consumers were aware and demanded it, it would be possible to change industry so that these chemicals were not so pervasive.
When you look at that list of potential health effects here, it's sometimes kind of astounding that it's not demanded. Ryan in Marshalltown, Iowa. Ryan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering about dose effects. I've heard that the dose makes the toxin, basically that anything at a high enough dose level is toxic. And so when you're talking about the toxicity of something, you have to consider not just whether it's there or not, but in what amounts you're getting it. And that people tend to latch on to fears over something being present, like a good example is formaldehyde traces in vaccines. And it's much harder to get rid of sort of that paranoia, even though the dose levels there are so small, they're smaller than what your body makes during daily activity.
Ryan, it's a great question, and let us pick it up if we may. I appreciate your call. And if I may, Mariah, I'm just looking here at a bunch of headlines from 1 year ago to this effect. I mean, Scientific American headline, new BPA experiment finds no low-dose effects. U.S. News, no ill effect found in human BPA exposure. NPR, maybe that BPA in your canned food isn't so bad after all. And
yes,
it's all about low dose. Ryan's
okay.
Point.
Well, first of all, endocrine-disrupting chemicals, according to virtually all studies by academic scientists, are different than other chemicals in that they can have very dramatic effects at low dose. And people who study this generally say that there is no safe dose. And it's actually different than other chemicals because it has this response curve. So actually, you can have a decrease effect as the dose goes up. This is counterintuitive and is hard for people to grasp. It was hard for me to grasp when I first started looking
at this. But how do you square it with the studies behind all those headlines just 1 year ago, Mariah?
Well, you have to look at the design of the study. So virtually all studies by academic scientists find these effects. Not a single study that is industry-funded finds these effects. And there are distinct differences in the design. So, for example, industry-funded studies usually use a type of rat that's known as the Sprague-Dawley, the Charles River Sprague-Dawley rat. Now, this is a mutant rat that was bred to be hyper-fertile, and it has... it is essentially insensitive to estrogen, so it can withstand doses of estrogen that are 100 times higher than a human female with no effects, according to one Japanese study. So you are testing a synthetic estrogen on an animal that does not respond to estrogen.
And you get a result, and the result makes the headlines, and on go the chemicals.
Exactly. So this is part of the strategy of sowing doubt about the science.
James in Viroqua, Wisconsin. James, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. I got to take it off speakerphone.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a food scientist. I've got a hospitality and food science degree from Washington State University. Mm-hmm. I work in the food packaging and processing industry right now in Wisconsin. And let me just tell you, if it comes in a package, you don't want to eat it. I know that sounds harsh. We have to feed 300 million people in America. There's really no way to do that without packaging in plastic. But if you want to be an educated or smart consumer, you don't want to buy anything that's packaged.
James, look at every supermarket in the country. Everything is packaged.
Absolutely. You're going to have to make some choices there, people. For me, I've got, you know, the luxury of living in a county where there's tons of organic agriculture. I can have raw milk delivered to my house in glass jars if I want to. I choose not to drink milk. But, you know, I also live in a northern tier state where there's a growing season of about 3 months.
Yeah.
So I have to make my choices as well. But, you know, I can just tell you that if it's packaged in plastic, it's a risk.
Boy, James, you send us off for fresh veggies and glass, I guess. I don't know what the answer is exactly here, but there's somebody who's right in the business. Mariah, stand by. James, thanks for your call. I want to bring R. Thomas Zeller into our conversation right now. He's a professor of biology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, expert on endocrine disruptors. That's kind of where the rub is here. R. Thomas Zeller, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
So what do you make of this? I mean, people are listening. They want to do the right thing by themselves, by their children, by their grandchildren, because the effects can be passed down, we're told. And yet we get these conflicting headlines. You get a huge story like Mariah's that makes you want to just run out and buy glass and fresh veggies. You hear our caller from Wisconsin saying if it's packaged, you've got issues. What do you say? You've studied this for a lifetime.
Right. I think a big issue is this concept that the dose makes the poison. So in this regard, I think it's important to recognize that poisons have certain kinds of effects. And those effects originally were evaluated with whether or not the animal died. That's really what we mean when we say the dose makes the poison. And if we give enough of anything, it'll be poisonous. But chemicals that interfere with the endocrine system fundamentally function differently at low doses,
okay,
because what they're doing is kind of hijacking hormone systems and having effects that are not acutely toxic but produce disease in different ways. So that's the rub. That's the two different perspectives.
Meaning that you can do a kind of traditional test on whether it's dangerous. Will it kill you at high enough dose?
Right.
And come up with the answer, no, it's not dangerous, but it may be dangerous in other respects. Surely that's not so hard for science to understand. Surely that's not the same as being safe.
That's not what the regulatory system was set up to do. They were really set up to protect people from death and severe disease that are acute. And, you know, one of the things that I often see is that if a chemical – if a food produces disease that's quick enough, then the regulatory system can pick it up. But if a pregnant woman consumes some product or chemical that affects the fetus that doesn't manifest until 20 years later, and we know cases where this is true, the regulatory system isn't designed to pick it up, and it's been reluctant to change.
You know, we look back and chuckle or slap our heads in wonder at the ancient Romans, who had a lot of lead in their drinking vessels and did a lot of damage to their brains with that, and just appear to have just gone on doing it. Are we in a comparable situation here with plastics?
I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think there will come a day when we look back and say that what we've allowed ourselves to do is to have policy driven by what we don't know, not by what we know. So, for example, in the story of George Bittner's test, if those plastics had no estrogenic activity in his test, it would be very unlikely to be estrogenic in people. That's something that we know, and that's what should drive policy and decisions.
R. Thomas Zeller, Mariah Blake, please stand by. Mary Beth is calling from Murray, Kentucky. Mary Beth, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. What my concern is the amalgam fillings that I had replaced with essentially a plastic filling, thinking that I was doing the right thing.
You're talking dental work, Mary Beth.
Dental work. And I didn't know if there was current research to tell me that maybe that was a big mistake.
Let's see if our guests know. Our Thomas Zeller, is BPA involved in dentistry?
Yes,
or amalgam?
It is. Yes.
Yes. Dental sealant. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you can take that one.
Mariah, jump in.
Dental sealants often contain BPA. And I believe fillings, these amalgam fillings as well. So this is a very common place.
That's in your mouth all the time. Do we know, Professor Zeller, that that's safe?
Well, that's – so first of all, safety kind of means different things depending on who you are. I think if you're an adult and you're kind of finished with your families –
What does that mean? Finished
families.
Reproducing or –
Finished reproducing.
Okay.
Then I think you're in a much better position. I think if you're a child, then I think that it's a very different kind of discussion. And, you know, even the kind of tooth sealants that they use, anytime they put a blue light in there to kind of catalyze – this reaction, that's they're using bisphenol A. There have been some studies that look at bisphenol A in the blood of people that have these procedures, and those levels are high. Now, bisphenol A is cleared fairly rapidly from the bloodstream, and so FDA will make the argument that that bisphenol A really doesn't last in the system long enough.
But if it's in your teeth, does it keep leaching or not?
Well, that's a good question. I think that it probably diminishes rapidly after the procedure. Whether or not you get low doses that are chronically released over years, I think probably isn't well understood.
Of course.
It's certainly possible.
But we have to treat our teeth. You go back, didn't we have mercury in the old fillings? I mean, are we setting a standard too high for safety here? You know, you want to treat things, you want to do things.
Right. Right. And I often think that one of the issues that we should talk about is what is the cost and what is the benefit? And when there are benefits, then maybe the risks that are sometimes unknown might be reasonable to consider. But when we have opportunities to change that, and I think one of the lessons from the issue of Certachem is that there are plastics that don't have this estrogenic activity, and so we know that we can do it. It's not a matter of it's really not a matter of whether we're able to do it and, you know, maintain the economy. We can do this.
I mean, Mariah Blake, one of the arguments that Eastman made fighting Certachem over this was that Certachem had its own dog in the fight, that they had their own BPA-free alternative here, and that may have played into their findings.
And that is actually not the case. They do not manufacture their own plastic. What they do is they test for estrogenic activity in plastics, and then they help companies find non-estrogenic alternatives.
You described a sister company called Plastipure.
Plastipure, yes. Plastipure, the sister company, helps them find non-estrogenic alternatives. So in most cases, they have identified commercially available plastics that are non-estrogenic that they point clients to.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the safety of plastics. BPA, with BPA and beyond, there's a big debate about risks to human health over a wide range of plastics going on out there right now. Mariah Blake writes about it in a big piece in Mother Jones. She joins us from Washington. You can link to her piece at our website, onpointradio.org. She really gets deep inside the fight over the science and perception of science that's being played out right now. Our Thomas Zeller is with us from Amherst, Massachusetts, professor of biology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, expert on endocrine disruptors. I want to pull the curtain back a little wider here because there's still so much BPA in our environment. The FDA, to say again, says it is safe at low dose, despite all the controversy around it, though the FDA has come and said, well, not in baby bottles, not in sippy cups, not in packaging for baby formula, but there's still a lot of it in our environment, in receipts, thermal receipts that you may get at the store, lining soup cans, and much, much more. Joining us right now from Cincinnati, Ohio, is Shuk Maho, Dr. Shuk Maho, chair of the Department of Environmental Health at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. She is director of the Cincinnati Cancer Center, lead investigator of a recent study that found a link between prostate cancer, big in men, and a higher level of BPA in men's urine. Shukmeho, Dr. Shukmeho, thank you very much for being with us. What was the bottom line finding of your research?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Such a pleasure. Call me May.
Okay.
So what happened is that we were really surprised. These are patients who are coming to our men's clinic for various reasons,
okay,
a regular checkup or other things. So we have recruited 60 such patients, and it turns out that when we were initially, of course, blind about their, I mean, we don't know their status about whether they're cancer patient or non-prostate cancer patients. So when we look at their bisphenol A level in the urine, we later on discover that the group that our cancer patient has fourfold higher levels of bisphenol A in the urinary.
Not two times or three times, but four times the level of the cancer-free men.
Right, correct.
Wow.
As opposed to the non-cancer patients. Mm-hmm. Those may be people who are coming in for a regular checkup, maybe an enlarged prostate or other benign diseases. So that was a surprise for us, because I have to admit, this is an association study, and also the sample size relatively is small.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the limitations that I write out, you know, want to, you know, clarify. However, this is probably the first study that is connecting prostate cancer to bisphenol A in a human clinical, clinical study in this case.
So despite the FDA warnings around infants and some infant products, despite all the controversy around BPA and lots of people's efforts to buy BPA-free plastics, clearly a significant number of men within your sample were still getting a lot of BPA because it flushes through the system pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's a very good point. We also measure the BPA only once. It's a cross-sectional study. That means they come into the clinic and we measured, took the urine and then measured the BPA. So, but if we look at the larger study that the Centers for Disease Control had conducted a couple of years ago, they found that 93% of Americans have measurable levels of BPA in their urine. And in fact, if you look at our levels in the prostate cancer group versus the non-prostate cancer patients, they are all within the range of what the CDC found. So this is not occupational exposure. This is not exceptional. This is just like even within the American population, we can find all this level.
Bisphenol A still there in canned food, of course, and in fillings, yes, and dental work, as we've heard, supermarket receipts, even dollar bills in your pocket.
Correct. And the other thing that is actually interesting is that if you use hand sanitizer after you touch some of these thermal receipts, it actually accelerated the absorption, the dermal absorption.
So if you buy the hand sanitizer and use it right away with your receipt.
So a lot of people, when they're traveling, okay, so they worry about, like, you know, they can't get
germs
to maybe a faucet or, you know, a restroom. They use hand sanitizers, and it turns out that it actually increases the absorption. So, but the other part of the finding was quite interesting, is that we found that patients who develop prostate cancer before age 65, they actually have bisphenol A level in the urine about eightfold higher than their age match counterparts.
Eight times higher. So somehow they're exposed to even that much more.
Well, I mean, the differential is more. That means that there was two possible explanations for that. First of all, for prostate cancer, is the highest risk factor for prostate cancer is aging. So the older you get, the more high, you know, risk.
Yeah.
In fact, maybe one out of eight men in the United States will probably get prostate cancer in their lifetime. However, those that develop prostate cancer later on in life, they are probably less worried about it. They probably should be put on active surveillance and not go through a lot of drastic, you know, procedures. They may choose to do that because those cancers are more not as aggressive.
But you're suggesting that if they could somehow stay away from bisphenol A, they might lower their chances maybe significantly in the first place.
This is absolutely, I think, a very good hypothesis that we are going to really pursue further, because this will be a very, I would say, low-cost, community-based public health intervention methods that you can actually use.
May, if I may call you May, you know, some
we
run around asking ourselves why there's so much cancer in our country.
Correct.
And then, you know, we hear from Mariah, from our Thomas Zeller, from you in this study, and sometimes it seems like we're just idiots, that the answer could be right in front of us.
Could be. So that's why we were very excited about this study. We've been getting a lot of press. And so, because this is something that we actually can control. There was a study showing that a husband and a wife living in the same household, their genetic background as well as their gender background are different. Their urinary bisphenol A levels are pretty comparable.
But two...
Suggesting it's a health or a lifestyle, is a lifestyle, you know, habit.
Yeah, but to Mariah Blake's point, you came out with this study and you had quite a rapid response from the American Chemistry Council. Describe that for us.
I can tell you how many hits we have. So it's almost like every 15 minutes. So that means hopefully I would take it as a positive spin, and it's probably important.
What was their reaction?
There's two major criticisms from most of the releases that they released. A is a small sample size. So for that, I will respond by saying that this our study will call for a much larger sample size study almost immediately. And also we should look at not just bisphenol A in the urine, but perhaps all those alternatives.
But was this trade group for the chemistry industry, was it looking to cast doubt on your findings?
Well, of course, we were never contacted. Their press release were coming out. I mean, their responses were coming out on the web like every couple of hours. So we were never contacted. We don't know how they get our papers, so we have no clue. So, but our embargo time was 5 p.m. on Monday, and their responses were so quick. Within like maybe half an hour, we saw the first one coming in.
Sort of firing back, or certainly commenting on your research.
Commenting that we are misleading the misinterpreting the data based on a very small sample size, as well as another criticism was that we only have done the measurement once. But you just pointed out a little bit early on, bisphenol A are clear out of the body within a very short period of time, maybe 24 hours. So if someone has a high level of bisphenol A in the urine, it is not really a measurement of what they're exposed to. It is just a reflection of their lifestyle, and that is more conducive to having a high level of exposure.
Of course, it clears out quickly. So if it's there, that means we keep using it. And indeed, many Americans' exposure would be more or less continuous.
Look at their lifestyle, what they're using. And these are things that could be the consumer can have a lot of control before that we have the regulatory agencies start banning, being able to remove bisphenol A from our environment. This offers, an opportunity for people to take things on their hands and being able to do something about it.
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily easy, given the way that distribution and packaging is generally systematically arranged in this country, but we take your point. Listen, we have a lot of callers with questions here, and with this terrific panel, I want to get to some if I can right now. Please stand by there in Cincinnati. Rich in Trumbull, Connecticut. Rich, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hi, my question is about the pH level of the food in the can or bottle and its ability to leach or maybe do something with the plastic or react with the plastic and leach it into the food, which we are ingesting. You know, I'm sure there's a difference between a can with tomatoes in it and maybe chickpeas. And what should we avoid maybe in the interim? Since these things take a lot of time to work themselves out, are there certain things that we should avoid maybe that have higher pH levels or lower pH levels?
Interesting question. I got it, Rich. Thank you. R. Tomasello, let me bring it to you. Are there particular foods that may interact with plastic packaging more aggressively to leach more potentially dangerous chemicals into the food?
Sure. I think that that is true, and I think tomatoes are a good example. And I'm beginning to see, for example, in Whole Foods that there's many more glass packaging for tomato sauce as well as tomato paste. So I think that the market is beginning to respond to this recognition. And remember, too, that fruit, canned fruit, most often doesn't have a lining. It doesn't have BPA lining. So
canned fruit, you're saying?
Canned fruit.
So what kinds of foods are more likely to have a BPA lining in a can?
Well, I think soup is one that's well characterized. Tomatoes, canned tomatoes are will leach more BPA than other kind of products. I think there are several websites that you can go to that really characterize the amount of bisphenol A that's leached into different kinds of food. And I think it's a good idea to take a look at that and make choices. There was a study done at Harvard that demonstrated that people that stopped using canned soup actually reduced their urinary BPA levels.
We will follow up with those websites and get them on our website so our listeners can link to them later. Thanks for that. And Rich, it sounds like you're on to a productive line of thinking right there. We're talking about the safety of plastics, BPA and beyond. Let's go to Nashville and Jackson. Jackson, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question has to do with I have to take injections every 10 days for medical reasons,
mm-hmm.
and I worry about myself and the millions of other Americans who are taking at-home injections or using breathing tubes and whatnot. Are we just slowly dosing ourselves into a new health issue?
Interesting. Well, medical devices. Who can speak to that? Shukmai Ho? May?
Yeah, well, we actually have a bunch of studies have shown that different types of tubings, plastic tubings that are used in medical devices, they can leach out different types of bisphenol A's. So I think there are websites that you can actually go to, and I'm sure that Tom will probably find those and then connect it to their links. One of the most dramatic studies that was done was the when they have those ICUs for babies who were born at much preterm birth. And they were on ICU, and many of the tubings that are going into their bodies, some of those are actually leaching out BPA. So, and that is a very vulnerable stage of their organ development because these are like perinatal, that means around birth. So that's kind of scary. But in terms of adulthood, I think Tom has alluded to earlier on, once we pass beyond the, quote, reproductive years, we are probably less vulnerable.
It's kind of overwhelming. We'll put up all the links that we can to help people sort this out. Thanks for that. One more call, Maya in Marfa, Texas. Maya, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call and having such a great show. I'm a chef and a grocery store owner in my community, and so I'm constantly curating food products for people. Reading about chemicals and additives, and I'm just so upset that the FDA doesn't ban more things that are especially banned in other countries for decades. How can concerned citizens be more proactive in having an influence over FDA decisions?
That's a great question. That gets to the politics of this and the public voice. Mariah Blake, what's your thought on that? How could the FDA encouraged to be a little more forward-leaning here?
Well, I think public awareness is the first step. So in the case of BPA, it was only when the public took an interest in this issue that industry and regulators acted. And in fact, in the case of BPA, the FDA banned BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups only after the industry requested that it do so, because the industry wanted to reassure consumers that its products were safe. The industry had actually removed BPA from these products already because consumers would only buy BPA-free products.
R. Thomas Zeller, how do we get this to change systemically? You've been looking at this for a long time.
That's a good question. I've been trying to look at that. I think that there's a couple of issues that are important. One is the kinds of tests that regulatory agencies do. They're just not adequate to pick up this kind of toxicity or this kind of effect, this adverse health effect. And I think that changing will be challenging, but it'll still be something that's necessary.
Well, Mariah Blake, in your piece, you point out just the kind of big brawl that breaks out when change gets close or when it's pushed. It's fascinating, deep read on this, and we're grateful for it. Mariah Blake, reporter with Mother Jones, thank you very much for being with us this hour, Mariah. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you very much.
R. Thomas Zeller at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, professor of biology there. Thank you, as always. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Shukmay Ho, Dr. Shukmay Ho, director of the Cincinnati Cancer Center, joining us today from Ohio. May, thank you so much for your insights today.
You are very welcome.
Listeners, thanks for all your great questions as well. There are many more online. Great conversation there. Check it out, onpointradio.org, or look for us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.